Where do we start this? And the answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Sell or Die. My name is Jeffrey Gittimer. I'm the author of The Little Red Book of Selling. And to my immediate out the porch window is...
I'm Jen Gluckow, founder and CEO of Sales in a New York Minute.
And we're in the separate rooms today so we can sound a little bit better for the podcast, but we are in Mexico.
Yeah, and Jeffrey so asked me to sit out on the porch.
Right, Jeffrey. What's your point? And exactly. And we are in Cabo, a place that is absolutely gorgeous. I'm giving a speech here tomorrow to a professional group, and I can't, it's not fair to say the name, but it's very nice. And it's sunny, it's 85 degrees. With the wind chill factor, that makes it 84 degrees. The food is amazing. The property, Paradisus, is amazing. Come down here and spend a few days. I promise you, it's worth 10 times the money.
So, Jeffrey, we should do an event down here where we do like a sales training in the morning or afternoon, and everyone gets to sit by the beach and pool during the day. I think we could do a fun event.
And can I make one suggestion?
Yeah.
Bring your producer with you. I'm stuck in cold and rainy Charlotte, North Carolina.
Wait,
Doug, it could be worse. You could be in New York where it's even colder.
That's right.
Yeah.
Jeffrey, I want to talk about Twitter. They've recently made some changes, and they're major changes, actually. So, you know, you used to be able to only put 140 characters in your tweet, and now they're allowing you to tweet 280 characters. That's a big change.
I think it's stupid. I think you can say what you want to say with a picture and 140 characters. I think this gives idiots a double chance to prove their idiocy. And it's not going to do well. That's just my prediction from the blue sky. And I'd like to point out that the people on the board of directors and the marketing people and the CEO of the company are absolute morons because they just missed a multi-billion-dollar opportunity. They're giving away 280 instead of charging for it as a premium. If they charge $10 a month for a premium Twitter, they would have hundreds of millions of people paying an extra 10 bucks a month or 120 bucks a year forever.
Totally.
They're jackasses. They are jackasses and a total absolute jackasses because anybody who's doing this would pay the 10 bucks. Gladly pay the 10 bucks.
I liked the challenge of like, sometimes my tweet would be 150 characters and I have to figure out exactly how to make it shorter. And I liked that. I thought it was, you know, thought provoking and it made my sentences better.
Jennifer is pointing to something that's sort of a philosophy in the creative arts that is sort of the constraints are what drives creativity. A lot of television shows that I've watched have been reborn from network television onto services like Netflix and Hulu. And with that rebirth of some of those television shows, you know, when you go to Netflix and Hulu, you don't have the same restrictions in terms of the explicit content that you could use or the length of your episodes. And there are several examples of shows that moved from network to Netflix and lost some of that creative zeal that they had when they were on network television because you had to be creative about dealing with explicit topics. You had to be creative in terms of how to get your idea into the, you know, 15 minutes of your 30-minute show.
Yeah, Doug's right. It's the constraint that helps create and bolster creativity. And it was their uniqueness. I mean, it was what made you knew when you went on Twitter, you had to really think about what you were going to say.
Did I mention that they blew a big financial opportunity by not charging for a premium
Jeffrey,
Twitter?
Can you tell us about it again?
But that hasn't been the Silicon Valley sort of social media model. I mean, everyone is chasing the Facebook model, which is open your service for free, get a billion people on there, and then charge advertisers for access to that data.
Totally.
But the Twitter ad program hasn't worked well. So they put a premium program in that you can still do 140 characters for free. And you pay for the 280.
I don't know. I think people would be in uproar.
No, there would be a bunch of people. There would be a bunch of people that would moan about it because they're all cheap bastards. And well, the ruination of the internet. That's bullshit. It would be a $1 billion bonanza for Twitter. Their stock would go up. Their revenues would go up. It would be a field day for them. Remember when everybody was bitching about Netflix raising their rate? What happened to Netflix? A, their stock went up, and B, their value went up.
Didn't Twitter try something like this in the past?
I don't know.
And it was—they tried something, and it only lasted like a month or two or a couple of weeks, and then they reverted back to 140 characters.
Yeah, and my favorite thing about this whole entire thing is that they always slow roll these kind of things. So they will give select users 280 characters, and when there was no announcement that everyone was getting 280 characters, so you had all of these people that were slowly they were bragging that they had 280 characters, that they were special. And then you could see on their timeline their slow realization that they were not special. I wanted to screenshot it and like make an entire Twitter account of people just realizing how small they were in the universe.
Yeah, it's hard to make a
picture. Let's talk about how this relates to sales. Imagine you get a salesperson double the time to present.
Nah, I think you'd die. I think you'd get all kinds of people rambling on to a point where you have to give the customer a bell. And when you're too boring or you're too stupid, they get to ring the bell. And I think that they would ring it after their initial allotted time. If you need more than 15 or 20 minutes to make a sales presentation, something's drastically wrong. Unless you're just freeze at a lunch or having coffee or something and talking about family or skiing or vacations or Cabo or, you know, whatever you have in common with anybody. I think that the meat of the presentation has to be how the customer takes value, what the benefit is after they take ownership, how much more will they produce, how much more will they profit, and then go home.
Mm-hmm. You know, I do a lot of networking in New York, and I go to some meetings where you can give a 30-second commercial about who you are, what you do, who you're looking to meet, that kind of thing. And I go to other meetings where you can give a 60-second or even 90-second commercial. And I always want to pull my hair out or ring that bell in the 60-second, 90-second commercial meetings because people show up totally unprepared, thinking they have all this time to talk about who they are, and they waste your time. Whereas in the 30-second commercial meeting, people know exactly how they're going to use that time. All 30 seconds is planned out. Some people practice in advance. And they really make it witty. They make it just fun for 30 seconds and you're not bored. And so my theory is the less time you have, the more you have to prepare and the better off you're going to be.
So the question is, should salespeople place restrictions on their presentations, even in terms of time, even if there is no explicit restriction on the length of a presentation?
I agree. If you're granted a one-hour meeting from a customer, tell the customer in advance, hey, listen, my presentation's only 15 minutes, so I'm going to spend 45 minutes talking about you and how the value that you'll receive as a result of us, you know, becoming connected.
Yeah, and you build a relationship during that time. I'd rather use 45 minutes to build a relationship and then 15 minutes to talk about how I can help. I think a lot of salespeople, though, do the reverse. They do 45 minutes about themselves, about their company, about their products, about why they're better than the competition, who they work with, and then they spend 15 minutes trying to build a relationship.
It never ceases to disappoint me how salespeople do not take advantage of their own time in front of a person that can say yes to them. When you're in front of that decision maker, the object is to make the relationship, not make the sale. The sale will come as a result of the relationship, not vice versa.
So, Jennifer, you want to get into the show?
No. I want to talk about how Twitter blew it. I want to talk about how Twitter blew it by not charging for their premium service.
$10 a person, even if they charge $5 a person per month.
Right. Hey, speaking of Twitter, we have a contest, a social media contest.
Doug, tell us all about that contest.
Yeah.
I'd love to. So it's called the Sell or Die Hard contest. It's exclusive for you out there and the rest of our loyal Sell or Die Hards that are listening to this show every Tuesday and Thursday. You can win a 30-minute strategy call with Jeffrey and Jennifer, and here's what you have to do. Subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. Rate us on iTunes or star us on Overcast. Take a screenshot and post that to Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and tag us at Gittimer and at Jen and Any Minute with the hashtag Sell or Die. So again, subscribe to the pod, rate us on iTunes, star us on Overcast, take a screenshot, post that to Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and tag us at Gittimer at Jen and Any Minute with the hashtag Sell or Die.
We will be choosing winners on November 20th. I am excited.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait till somebody actually follows those instructions.
They're not that difficult. If you look at any of our social media, we've been posting a picture with the instructions. So, and we'll put it in the show notes.
We'll clarify it a little bit better on Twitter when they go to 280 characters.
Yeah, we have all that extra room now.
And not charge for it. So we have a great guest today. Who's our guest today, Jen? Remind everybody that our
the one, the amazing Carson Hedy.
And he's a guy who, first of all, he's a sales guy. Second of all, he works for a big company. Third of all, he's very successful at it. He's the number one rep in the company. Fourth of all, he has written two novels about sales and salesmanship that are, and we sort of, I don't know, milked it out of him during the interview that it's relatively autobiographical. But the bottom line
is, he said they are not autobiographical.
Oh,
for
bullshit.
The we'll debate that till the end of time.
Right. But the bottom line is he's written two novels. Now, the one thing that I want everybody to understand in this is to listen carefully to the interview. And he's going to tell you how it became possible for him to do this. It wasn't just whim of the week. He'd been thinking about this since he was a child. And finally, he put it into action and made it a reality. This interview is great and great for a salesperson and inspirational. If you are looking for a new way to succeed at sales, Carson is going to show you that path. Please help me welcome the great Carson Hedy.
Let's welcome in Carson V. Hedy. He's the author of 3 sales leadership books, including Birth of a Salesman.
Yeah.
He also serves as a corporate territory manager for Microsoft. He's been the number one company contributor in 8 roles across 4 companies. That's amazing.
That's pretty good.
In multiple levels of sales and leadership. And he's been featured in numerous publications and podcasts. Welcome, Carson.
You're now a feature on our podcast.
Happy to be here. And this is like the ultimate because I'm amongst sales royalty. So this is this is the crown jewel of the podcast.
You're correct, and an excellent judge. But I want to I'd sort of like to begin by asking a little bit about you. What inspired you to write? I mean, what said, you know, hey, I'm sick and tired of doing this for Verizon and Microsoft. I think I'm going to write a book.
It's a great question. I think a lot of it was I used to write for a company newsletter at AT&T, and I'd always wanted to write a book. I wrote when I was a kid, and whether it was throwing people that I went to class with into a time travel adventure, novel type stuff. So I kind of wanted to write a novel. I kind of wanted to write a sales book. But, you know, that sort of stuff's been done a lot, and it's been done well a lot. Present company included. And, frankly, I wanted to do something different. So I actually wrote a sales book inside of a novel, created a fictional character going through several experiences in a corporate environment. And each chapter would be a story he was telling about how he learned these lessons. And I was inspired to do it because I enjoyed writing and I enjoyed talking about sales. I became very passionate about it in my 20s. And frankly, it's funny, I look back now and I can't believe I had the audacity to write about sales in my 20s because I knew relatively nothing back then. But I was inspired to do it because I was passionate about the topic and hoped that I would be able to make a difference in salespeople's lives.
How do you think that writing has played a role in terms of your being number one? Is there any correlation there?
Possibly. I think the communication piece is key because, all of sales is relationships and building relationships. And a lot of that is being able to communicate, whether it's via email, whether it's being able to follow up, whether it's incorporating the messages that you've learned and that you're able to convey throughout the years. Plus, being successful in sales is not all about yourself. It's also about being able to learn from others. Pick up best practices. I consider myself a sponge, and the older I get, the more I continue to learn. It's important to be able to write to other people that especially in a global company like I'm at right now, be able to write to a peer that's doing phenomenally well across the country, across the world, and ask them for nuggets of wisdom. So I definitely feel that the writing has helped. I know for a fact that the writing also, it's been another thing that has set me apart on a resume. For instance, I'm having it look because of that. And, that's helped me get jobs in the past and be noticed. So I definitely think it's helped and inspired success there.
And do you use your book as a calling card, or do you have one of their marketing prepared calling cards from Microsoft that all kind of look alike?
Well, you know what? Our title has changed so many times over the last couple of years with a lot of restructuring, which has been great. So I don't have a standard card at the moment. I'm waiting on my new one. But I do have a stack of books in my trunk. So I always carry them around as a calling card. Great question.
That's yeah. Cool. Well, actually, we're expecting our autographed copies any day now.
Yeah, I keep checking the mail, The mail lady came today and she said there were no books from Carson.
She actually called you a cheap bastard, which I didn't really think was appropriate, but...
I've been called a lot worse.
Signed copies.
We send them back if they're not signed.
That's fair. That may have been what happened the first time.
That could be. Yeah, the post office tried to read them.
I won't make that mistake again.
Then they realized they couldn't read, which is one of their obstacles. When you started out in sales, did you have success right away, or were you beating your head up against the wall?
You know, I'd love to say that I had success right away, but I think the key piece for me was I never intended to get into sales. And I think there's a lot of people that fit into that category. I didn't even realize I would enjoy it.
I think it's most.
Frankly, I agree. I think that, there's a lot of folks that get into it because, can be a very good paycheck. There's always folks looking for salespeople. I thought I was getting into a customer service job.
They tricked you?
So does every banker, and so does every marine biologist.
Yeah. Marine biologist, right? Yeah. I've never pretended to be one. George on Seinfeld.
There's no fish in St. Louis.
That's
I mean, even in the river, if you catch a fish in the Mississippi River, the fish like tells you to go to hell and takes the hook and throws it out of her mouth.
They don't say hell in St. Louis. They're very polite there.
As many fish as football teams. And trust me, I believe that there is probably plenty of vulgarity. I'm not the expert on that, but yeah, I got into a pretty grueling training and, I got out on the sales floor and, I very quickly realized what I was good at, and it was just the gift of gab, getting to know these folks and trying to figure out what was ailing them and if I had something that could fit the gap. And, I've been in sales in a lot of different capacities. I've sold things that I felt were pretty high quality. I've sold things that probably weren't, and definitely learned a lot in both capacities. So definitely didn't necessarily even anticipate getting into sales, but I did find what I would say is quick success, just because I felt like each time I've been in a role, it's figuring out the game. It's figuring out the playing field and the parameters, what helps you be successful, what's the right process, and how can you best be an advocate for your customer.
So one big question, are you Vincent Scott in disguise?
No comment. In fact, there's a disclaimer at the beginning that states that all the characters
are fictional.
But they had to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
Sure. I've got a very, very vivid imagination. No, it's funny because I think that over the course of the last couple of decades in the selling environment and the working world, I've certainly picked up a lot of experiences or heard stories from others and had a lot of experiences from that vantage point. So I would be lying to say that those types of things didn't influence, you know, my ideas, but it's definitely all fiction.
So, I got you.
So yeah, Jeffrey just mentioned Vincent Scott.
Hold on, we're
going to
write that down. We're going to write that down.
That's all right, please. Yeah. Yep, take a note.
So Jeffrey just mentioned Vincent Scott, and for our listeners who don't know, that's the main character in your book.
That's correct.
And tell us a little bit about him. What kind of salesperson is he?
Well, I would call him Superman with a briefcase. So what kind of sales guy is he? You know, really, I think he's very flawed, very human. I try to put a lot of very human elements into the guy because I've seen a lot of people in my sales career. I've worked with and hired and worked for a lot of people, and I wanted to make him very relatable. So, you know, very flawed and very very much going through a lot of, very much weaned on the environments that he was in too. I mean, the key thing for me in sales and for a lot of people in sales, I think, is just you get into an environment and again, you learn the playing field, you learn the parameters, and you try to master that facet of the game. And I think that he's very competitive and he's very eager to learn and eager to be the best. And he's fueled by that. He's very much a competitor. But a lot of times, too, as you guys know, being experts in your craft as well, it isn't often that you can go through your career completely unfettered by outside forces, bureaucracy, things like that. So he, you know, he has some negative reactions to some of these things because he's a kid. He moves up pretty quickly through the ranks. And he has a lot of interesting scenarios that he comes upon.
So I have an idea for you. I'm going to give you a book idea if it's okay.
I love it.
Okay.
Jeffrey, you've never done that on our show before.
No.
Given someone a book idea.
The title is Vincent Meets His Match. Enter Vanessa Scott, who he marries because she's kicking his ass.
Okay.
Out in the field, and she can teach him a hell of a lot more lessons than he can teach himself, because as a woman, she's had more struggles, she's had more glass ceilings and more rebuff because she's a woman. And you can write a whole other gender into your novel, and I think pick up a lot more readers.
I think that's spectacular. In fact, it reminds me, I'm a huge James Bond and Sherlock Holmes fan, and I recall Ian Fleming actually wrote The Spy Who Loved Me specifically from the female point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I could write women super well, but maybe I could find a co-writer for that project.
Well, maybe the wife can help you out.
Perhaps. She's a better communicator than I am.
Tell us what your favorite, you said that Vincent Scott teaches himself a lot of lessons. What's your favorite lesson that he learns in the book?
Yeah.
People in process, you know, be an advocate for people, whether it's your customer. Oh,
wait. Tell us about some miraculous.
Well, how does he learn that lesson? We want to hear a story. Come on.
Did a miraculous.
Wait a minute. Did Vincent Scott sleep his way to the top? That's what I've heard.
Oh, Jeffrey.
Unfortunately, no. I think he may have tried in his younger, dumber days, but it didn't work well for him.
So where's his big sale? What's his conquer? What's his, you know, was he working on something for his 27th year and he finally made his quota and got his boss fired?
Yeah, he got some steak knives, right?
Yeah.
After he got a hold of the Glengarry leads. Yeah. You know, I think the big learning for Vincent was that love and life was a hell of a lot more important than what he was trying to do in his career. And that once he got that in order, he was a lot more effective in the selling field. So that was his biggest personal win, frankly. But from a sales perspective, you know, the sales were all across the board and the lessons were all across the board from whether it's sales rep, sales manager, and then some entrepreneurial stuff that he did briefly, you know, but he wasn't afraid to take risks. And as you guys know, I mean, you can learn a lot from doing that, good and bad.
Totally agree. I think it's spectacular that you have taken your job and sort of morphed it into a writing career as well. Did all of your employers know that you were a good writer?
Well, I don't know that I'm a good writer. I think the jury's still out on that.
Did all of your employers know that you were a shit writer?
Yes. Most of them know that. Yes, absolutely. It's funny because, you know, I'll still to this day, I had a meeting couple months ago, and with a gentleman visiting from out of town that I'd never met. I mean, we had worked in the same circle, and he actually asked me to autograph my book. It doesn't happen as often as it used to, but it's funny because it was somebody that from a working circle with whom that happened. I've got bosses that'll tell me they bought it and are reading it, and I have mixed thoughts on that because I wrote the first one almost 10 years ago, so my philosophies have changed a lot. But I think for the majority, yes, over the last several years, there's a lot of folks that have known that I've done it. And I'm sure they probably have mixed thoughts on it. But again, from my vantage point, I feel like it's definitely helped because it's opened a lot of doors that wouldn't have been there otherwise.
No argument. And I think you're overlooking the fact that now you could probably make it into a course and put yourself a hell of a lot higher up on the totem pole, just by virtue of the internet.
Yes, that's been a game changer. I think one thing that I've definitely learned over the last few years is just how much of a tool social media can be, and especially from a networking perspective, prospecting perspective. You've got to have all the tools in play to get the face-to-face meeting. And ultimately, nothing will ever replace the value of the face-to-face and the relationship. But if you can help broker those relationships by using social media and the internet, you can go so far.
Broker, I think, is an interesting word. To me, it's like, can you attract that right person? Are they paying attention to what you're thinking and what you're saying? And when you call them on the phone, do they go, oh, yeah, that's it?
Or do they want to call you on the phone?
Yeah.
Sure.
But I want to go back a second. You just said that you wrote your first book 10 years ago, and now a lot of your or some of your philosophies have changed. What's changed in the past 10 years?
Well, yeah, I started in a kind of a one-call close type of an environment. That's completely different. The chances of ever talking to some of these folks again is next to none. So you have to bring out all of your tools on call number one, if you're even lucky enough to get to the decision maker. The other piece to that is now everything I do is relationship based. Whereas it wasn't 10 years ago. So a lot of my philosophies then were really around, how do you get in? Quickly differentiate yourself from all the schmucks that they've turned away before. How do I very quickly get their attention and figure out what ails them and get them to give me a little bit of trust when they don't even see me? So a lot of that was over the phone. Now I've spent a lot of time over the last few years face-to-face selling, in management roles and in individual contributor roles, and it's completely different. There's a lot of no selling conversations and really just getting in and figuring out, talking about the industry and listening to them talk about the gaps in their business and how potential solutions that I could provide would be a difference maker, save a company. Millions of dollars. So I think a lot of the differences have been around the relationship side. I value the relationship a lot more than I did 10 years ago.
It sounds like it was much more transactional 10 years ago.
Very much so. Yes, that's accurate.
And so what's your day job?
What the hell do you do?
Well, I sit around and I pray for a football team to come to St. Louis.
That's a low-level prayer.
Keep praying.
Maybe your hockey team will make the – never
hey,
mind.
Hey, you know what? Every year we've got a special dream. So
that's true.
Your baseball team
is kind of always there. You have a solid baseball backing.
We've been very fortunate the last decade plus with that question. Hockey, we had Brett Hull and Wayne Gretzky one season and couldn't even get past the first round. But we still love them. I think the key thing for me has been, we've been blessed with sports, not so much with football. But my day job, I'm a corporate territory manager for Microsoft, little company you may have heard of. We sell software and hardware and licenses.
Solutions.
Lots of licenses.
And you know how to do it. You do it through distributors, correct, or resellers?
The preponderance of our business is through our valued partners. So I manage a lot of that activity for a named territory. Yes.
And do they call you in on sales calls, or are you just behind them, going, "Way to go! You're their cheerleader. You're their information provider." Do you actually go out on the sales call and bang heads with people?
A lot of times, you know, I want to be as involved and in the field as I can. So a lot of times, yes. And sometimes it's as involved as the partners or the clients want me to be, frankly. Yeah, obviously, I try to bring as much value. And again, that's, you know, that's the role. It's just trying to find which way can mm-hmm. I best bring value mm-hmm. To the conversation. There's a lot of them that have great relationships with their existing partners. If there's ways that I can add additional value from a Microsoft standpoint, that's my goal to do it. Sometimes they're looking for a partner or a change of partner, and I try to get involved to figure out which one's going to be the right one. So there is a lot of selling too. As you can probably imagine, I mean, things have changed so much in technology over the last decade plus, you know, with so much focus on cloud and security. So a lot of our solutions are very much tailored toward that. And it's important to stay up to snuff on all of it.
Do you find that the reseller, your partner, can be intimidated for the fact that one day you may take over that and eliminate them?
You know, I think that in some cases, I've definitely seen, and it's been a good learning experience because I've been in this role for a year and a half, and it's different than anything that I've ever done. It is important to make sure you're adding value to them just like you're adding to a client. Mm-hmm. You know, I need to be their advocate. I need to be a proponent of them. I need to understand what unique differentiators they bring to the table over another partner and understand the history of the relationship. And let's face it, no matter how good somebody is in a situation, there can be some customers that love them, some that hate them. So you've got to figure out kind of the sum of the parts, and it's good constructive coaching in those situations, because you're able to take that and say, hey, this is the perception, and if it's not the reality, then we need to change the perception, and this is how we can do it. So a lot of collaboration.
Cool. So pre-value with these partners that you're working with, you haven't yet established any value, you're going to meet them. How do you establish that relationship? How do you build the rapport? What do you do? What's your secret sauce?
Well, part of it is getting to know them and what's their motivator, because they all get paid differently and there are all different incentives that they have. And a lot of them do a great job of mimicking what we do and try to follow our model so that, you know, that it makes sense and all, my goals will translate to their goals. But in some cases, I mean, again, you've got to understand the nuances and the unique pieces of their business. And my goal, again, it's just like talking to a customer. You know, I call it the sales food chain. I mean, in essence, you're making sure that everybody next to you on the sales food chain is taken care of from a needs perspective. So I want to understand what are their motivating factors? How can I best add value to their business? Are there clients that I can help get them in front of, and vice versa? Because I can't tell you how many times there's been times I've been wanting to get in front of a client and I can't get them to return my call for whatever reason, and I get a partner to get me in there. Now, more often than not, I can easily get in there and then help bring a client, bring mm-hmm. a partner. So again, there's give and take, because they're wanting to sell me on why they're the go-to partner, just like I'm wanting to sell them on, hey, I can bring you value, I can help you in on these accounts, and this is what we're both going to get out of it by collaborating.
Do you know the most powerful thing you can do for any one of your clients? There's one single thing that you can do that will make you the hero, the Bill Gates of St. Louis. I think if you can win back a lost customer mm-hmm. that was sizable for that client, where they lost somebody because they either screwed up or the service was lousy or the software didn't perform, whatever it was. If you can go in and win back that customer, you are a hero, a folk hero in the eyes of that reseller.
I like it.
And I think that you should ask all of your resellers to please make a list of all the customers that they have lost and try to call them up and find out, you know, just make it a mission to find out why they lost. Maybe some of the people that eliminated Microsoft don't even work there anymore. And maybe they had some personal, you know, thing. And if you're the best solution now, especially with cloud, maybe there's an opening.
Yeah, I agree. It's a lot like a romantic relationship. I mean, obviously there was some love there at some point. The fire flickered out and
but usually you do not want to take back your ex. Just saying.
Yeah, no, I in most cases, that's true. Yes. All but one in my case. I took back one X and it ended up lasting.
Oh, wow. That's cool. Okay, yeah. Cool.
But I think that you're looking at it from a standpoint of they're beaten, they're dejected, they lost in their own mind, they counted up the money that they lost, and now you come in on the white horse and you can get that customer back. And at least if you've tried to do it, I think that they're going to value your relationship that much more.
Agreed. I think anytime you're able to show the other person next to you on the sales food chain, whether it's customer, whether it's partner, whether it's member of your team, that you are a proponent of them, that you're an advocate of them, and you're actually doing that legwork. And it, heck, you could do 10 actions on their behalf and lose five of them. But if they see that action and they see that activity of you advocating for them, they will be a believer. And to your point, you know, if you're able to find a different way to solve a problem, because again, they failed going that way up the wall. Well, you found a way around it. You're the hero. I very much agree with that philosophy.
So these resellers of yours, do they resell your competition products too?
In a lot of cases, yes, which, you know, again, it provides a unique challenge because there's sometimes where I get why I'm not on the dance card for that meeting. So, you know,
well, how do you stand out? Like, how do you make it so that they're thinking about you every single day?
A lot of it's being top of mind and about being mindful of the process that we've put in place. So if we've, you know, again, we've got an action plan that has been put in place. We've got a cadence set up where we are touching base on a weekly basis. You know, it's making sure that I'm following through on the things, on the deliverables, because frankly, that is a big miss and it's something that you can't overlook. I mean, these hustle stats, these things that keep us in the game, you know, they are often the differentiators. And frankly, if you're the one who's delivering, if you're the one who's getting them in front of clients they want to see, if you're the one that's following through on commitments and executing, they're going to keep turning back to you. Especially too, if you've been able to, if you've been able to garner a good relationship with their end client, and again, I mean, it all comes down to a needs basis. I understand that there's, and I think one thing that we've done as a company very well over the last few years is learn how to play very well in the sandbox with a lot of competitors. So there's room at the table for competitors. So embrace it rather than push it away. Figure out how your solutions can best match the gaps, whether it's alongside a competitor or whether it's solo.
Cool.
But you have one or two products that others will say just like. So, for example, it's just like Microsoft Word.
Yep.
Okay, I'll take Word. Oh, it's just like Excel. Okay, well then I'll take Excel. And as you know, more accountants want Excel than anything. More writers want Word than anything. And you have a tactical advantage. I'm not going to go to PowerPoint because it's a whole other story. But I think that you have an issue where you can always get to the table. You're fucking Microsoft, for God's sakes.
Yep. I mean, it definitely helps. I won't sugarcoat that. I've worked in some locales in the past where I had a lot more challenge getting to the table. Here, not as much, because frankly, there are a lot of inherent ways that we can add value. People need our support and I'm here to bring it. So that helps open a lot of doors, no question. But once you're in there, what are you going to do with that door open?
Exactly.
And that's where the process is key.
And then how will you move to Redmond and get to buy an overpriced house?
So what are your next steps for books? Do you have any new books coming out?
You know, I thought I was completely done with that. And
I hear an announcement.
It's a time thing, right? I mean, you guys know what a commitment that takes. And, you know, I've managed to write 3 books in 10 years. And, you know, but I do have some ideas for another one. It's timetable, no clue. But, you know, it's to our point of what we've been talking about. I mean, we're always evolving and there are always.
Have you sketched it out yet?
I've got a preliminary outline. Put it like that.
What would you tell someone who is writing a book? How do they allocate that time? How do they make that time to write it?
You've got to schedule it and stay on task with it and just write every day. I've seen so many people that, and it's great. I love it when people say, "Oh, hey, I'm trying to write a book. I'm doing this or that," and couple months later, you don't hear any more about it.
Exactly.
They've given up.
It's a lot like anything. It's a lot like diets. It's a lot like, hey, I'm changing my sales strategy.
Hey, watch it over there.
Doing this and that. Hey, I've been there too.
We happen to be fat over here.
Hey, speak for yourself.
Oh,
that's not the picture I see. But anyway, I think that, you know, it's like anything. It comes down to consistency. It's just like selling. I mean, you're not going to have any results unless you're consistent in execution of process. So writing's the same way. You've got to be consistent in your execution of process. You've got to do it every single day. And if you miss a day, you know what? Don't tell yourself that, oh, I screwed up. I'm never going back and doing it. Just carve out some time the next day. But I think having that scheduled time where you're going to focus on that piece do it and just write. Who cares? I've been so mad at like where I've been in the writing process in the past. Like I was halfway done and I was like, I'm never going to finish this. But if you just write a little bit each day and then it takes shape and you'll figure it out.
I will tell you that I had the privilege of introducing and spending a day with Og Mandino, the guy who was the first founder of he was president of Success Magazine for a while, but he founded his own foundation. You know, he wrote The Greatest Salesman in the World.
And I know I wanted that title, but it wasn't available.
But he would wake up every day and write one page on a typewriter.
Oh,
no word processor, no. He just kind of knew where he was going, and he'd bang out one page a day and put it on a pile. And eventually he had a book, and he did several books, and it worked for him. But you're exactly right. It's a page a day. I write now voice to text, which I have found to be the most prolific thing for me. I will tell you that one of the flaws of Word is that when there is...
don't tell him.
When you put those remarks on the right-hand side, what do you call that?
Comments.
Comments on the right-hand side, you can no longer do voice to text.
Well, I will take your feedback, and I will escalate it.
Yeah, go for it, dude. If you can't do that...
It doesn't integrate fully with Dragon Dictate. That's the issue.
Just so go tell him, please, and tell him that... It's pissing me off.
I'm on the case.
Thank you very kindly.
I'll report back later today.
All right. So how do we find you? If people are now interested in this. Actually, I'm interested in this.
Yeah, we're waiting for our signed copies. But how do other people get their books?
Absolutely. So the book's available through Barnes & Noble and on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
I've got all three of them. And I've actually got an ultimate edition that I recently revised with all three of them.
Ooh.
And I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter.
Wait a minute. It's a trilogy. So why don't you give us the web address or give us the, say the title so that people can have them.
Yep. So I'm on WordPress. And just if you want to just look me up, Carson Hetty, you'll easily find me. I'm the guy who is not the 15-year-old bull rider in Missouri. I think I'm the only other Carson Hetty out there.
So but is it CarsonHetty.com?
Bull rider in Missouri.
Do you own CarsonHetty.com?
No, you know what? I dumped the website a few years ago, so now it's just my WordPress blog.
Oh, okay.
But do you have the URL?
I do. It's long. I'll send it to you.
But what happened
to Carson? So you're just saying, like, Google Carson Hetty or go to Amazon and look up Birth of a Salesman, Salesman Against the World, and A Salesman Forever.
Yeah.
Correct.
Cool.
Okay.
Yep.
We'll take care of it for you. Carson, don't worry about it.
I appreciate that.
No problem.
I used to have the domain, and then I dumped it a few years ago. So.
Oh, man.
Hello.
Hey, Carson, it's been, with or without your domain name, it's been a pleasure having you on our show.
And don't forget that Microsoft Word tip.
Yeah. Hey, I've already taken the note, and it's going to be the next thing I did.
Okay. Okay. Cool.
No, this has been fantastic. I'm really, truly honored. You guys are great, and I feel honored to just be part of the conversation.
Well, I hate to tell you this, but you did a pretty damn good job.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care. Nice to talk to you.
Likewise. Cheers. Thanks a lot.
Well, that interview was compelling to me because as a writer myself, I can totally understand what this guy has gone through. And I'll tell you, I just write nonfiction. I write what I consider to be factual. For this guy to character develop and put in a philosophy, you have no idea how hard it is. I'm working on a novel called Kill the Sale. And it's pretty involved. But the bottom line is that it's going to take me years to write. And literally, it'll be the last thing that I write. I'll probably, on my deathbed, I'll be finishing out the last few chapters so somebody else will get all the money. But the bottom line is, it takes time. And it's a process. I would have to go away for a year to finish a novel. Everybody does.
I wonder how many of our listeners have been considering writing a book or, a novel, whether it be a novel or a nonfiction book.
And everyone thinks about writing a book. Every person does. They go to a bookstore and they say, wow, someday I want to write a book. Unfortunately, someday is not a day of the week. And so they have to say, like, Monday I'm going to write a book. And that way they actually start to do it.
Carson did it, I think, while he was working, which is pretty impressive. You know, he was selling and making
When I do public seminars, I ask the audience, how many of you have ever considered writing a book? And almost the whole audience raise their hand. And I say, keep your hand up if the first chapter is written. And no one raises their hand.
Yeah.
So it's a function of they want to do it, but they're not deeply enough to be able to actually take action.
Hmm. Well, you know, I'm writing a book right now, and I find that I do my best writing when I get a little sun and I'm relaxed and I'm in, you know, just a very relaxed state. And so I don't know if that helps others, but I jam out so much more when I can see the water and see some palm trees and feel the sun than when I'm just sitting in my office. Even though my office is incredibly inspirational, just there's something that strikes me when I'm outside.
Well, I think that Carson has hit the nail on the head. I think that there's a book in everybody, but you know, his journey was from the time he was a young kid. He always wanted to write a book. He always wanted to write a novel. And then finally, as an adult, he did it. But that thought process may have lasted 25 years until he actually picked the pen up or picked the computer up to be able to do it.
The other cool thing about Carson is that, you know, he's been number one wherever he's gone. Maybe not wherever, but he's held four positions as the number one sales guy or sales leader. And that says something. You know, if you're the number one guy at some company once, great. But if you're consistently the number one guy or gal at, you know, multiple companies, then there's a story there. It's what you're doing. It's not what the company's doing. It's what you're doing to become number one.
And he worked at it. I mean, obviously, there's a discipline that's involved in writing. And it's the same discipline that's involved in sales. He is disciplined to win. He wakes up in the morning and he writes. And then he wakes up, you know, whatever his schedule is, I think we should have him back to find out what his schedule actually is and how he disciplines himself to win.
I agree. But, you know, his asset, one of his major assets is his ability to communicate. And that seems to be getting lost in our day and age. Like, people don't communicate in the same way that they used to.
What do you mean?
Well, now it's all online, on email. I'd rather pick up the phone and talk to you and have a conversation where I can hear how you're sounding, or even better, see you, sit down with you face to face. You know, whereas now it's like, well, let me just send an email. No, don't send an email. Call. Pick up the phone.
Yeah.
It's
communication.
Just a different way to communicate.
Yeah, communication is definitely morphing and changing. I wonder, like, if it's less about like how you're communicating than it is interpreting how you should communicate with people, like what medium you should take, because some people don't want to be bothered on the phone.
That's true.
I think a lot of people take a blanket approach with what they're comfortable with, right? Like, I'm comfortable with email, so I'm going to email everybody instead of worrying about like, ooh, how will an email be okay in this situation?
Hey, yeah, let's go back to our contest because I want to make sure that we're doing this thing right. Doug, can you remind us of what people need to do?
We're running a contest this week. It ends on November 20th. We'll select a winner, and it's exclusive for our sell or diehards out there. That includes you, the people who listen every week, Tuesday and Thursday, to this podcast. You can win a 30-minute strategy call with Jeffrey and Jennifer, and here is all you have to do. Subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already, then rate us on iTunes, or if you use Overcast, you can star us. Then take a screenshot of that review or star and post that to Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and tag us at Gittimer and at Jen in any minute so we know you're there, and then hashtag it with sell or die.
You know, it doesn't sound as complicated the second time I heard it. It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's really simple. Subscribe, rate, post, tag us. Come on.
Yeah, like she said.
Stop, drop, and roll.
Exactly. So I want to thank everybody. We're growing every week. We have a lot of people to be grateful for. We're trying to improve the show in a manner that will give everybody an ability to sell more and have more fun when you're, you know, if you have 20 or 30 minutes to listen to our podcast, we're very grateful for that. And we try to keep it A, lively, B, informative, and C, valuable to you, the salesperson, valuable to you, our valued customer.
Cool. So until next time, I'm Jen Gluckow.
And I'm Jeffrey Dittimer. I've authored The Little Red Book of Selling, and I'm challenging you to go out there and make yourself a sale, even if your ass falls off.
Oh, yeah.